So, good evening, everyone. It's just considering sharing something that's affecting me quite a lot at this moment. And I think I will share it. Reminding us all that we're brothers and sisters in aging, illness, and death. A friend of a friend passed away last night, and just an hour ago I was reminded of the incurable cancers some close friends, family members I have. So tonight, wanting to speak from that knowing of that preciousness and fragility of this life. So I'll share a few reflections on passion on the path, and a few of my favorite quotes from the canon and so on. And just now, as we're sitting silently, I was considering this sharing. What came to mind was a piece of a poem by another person who just recently passed away, Mary Oliver. I'm not good with quotes out of memory, but considering the undeniable truth that death walks among us in this garden where we play and exert ourselves and relax. What do we want to do with this one wild, precious life of ours? But onto a bit lighter themes. So we've been speaking a lot about dispassion and this practice, this path. We could call it a path of dispassion, actually. That dispassion is such a central thing. It can be called such, at least, like Catherine was saying, seclusion. Dispassion and cessation, viveka, viraga and nirodha. And from one point of view, we could say that most of these practices, if not all of these practices, are heading towards dispassion. Especially if we understand dispassion in the sense that we can, in the sense we can at least imagine it being meant to be in the earlier context, not in this removed from contact, removed from the life that Catherine was referring to last night, as it's come somewhat to mean in our Western tradition, but more in the tradition of the East, of the Buddhist tradition, how letting go is a dispassionate act. And the path of the Dharma is the path of letting go, the path of dispassion. And there are many ways to hold on, and likewise there are many ways to let go. And a few of those we've practiced here on the retreat. Just to open that up a little bit, we could say that the practice of samadhi, of calming the body and mind, the unification and harmonizing of one's being, is a kind of deeper degrees of letting go, we could say. That what happens when the body unifies and harmonizes is that kind of delineations and barriers we instinctively would be fabricating into experience of mind being here, thoughts being here, body being there, pain being over there, limited to that area. Those borders start to dissolve as we unify and harmonize the sense of the body. It kind of mixes together, dissolves together. And as that happens, we can say that there might still be energy, agitation, restlessness. It's not a linear, simple thing. It's actually quite complex, as we've noticed. And further, the letting go will deepen that presence and will deepen that samadhi. So we can say that samadhi is a path, is a practice of letting go. Likewise, the three characteristics you have spoke of are practices, ways of looking which make letting go possible, which may create conditions where letting go happens. And likewise, the practices of the heart, which we have not emphasized as much so far on this retreat, ones of metta, goodwill, compassion, joy and equanimity. And likewise, the movement, the felt sense of them, is one that lets go, one that does not separate, but rather brings together or loses the imagined, the fabricated sense of being separate. So with metta, we wish for others happiness and goodness of all sorts that we would wish for ourselves, or the other way around if the inner critic is too hard for us to wish goodness for ourselves. With compassion practices, when that sense of separation dissolves, we feel the other person suffering, the other being suffering. And just as we would soothe ourselves if we hurt ourselves, we want to soothe the other as well. One of practices of dispassion, instead of fabricating more, we're taking it down instead. Instead of creating stories, creating structures, creating separateness, the dissolving of that. And hearing that, it's interesting then to think, okay, so how does passion, what part does passion play here? It sounds like it's the opposite, that what we're to do is actually to let go of that, is to let that dissolve as well. And you already kind of know where I'm going with this. It doesn't work like that. It's not that easy. Actually, the contemplative path asks for a lot of passion. Like I mentioned on the opening night, something that's felt to me quite evident here, looking at all of the people here, many of whom I know, some whom I've met here. It's very evident, the passion. Very lovely. And the Buddha has a few words about passion as well, or pointing towards passion on the path, the necessity of it, we could say. So here he's talking of some qualities: internal tranquility of awareness, and insight into phenomena through heightened discernment. Sounds pretty good. And a practitioner who notices that he has achieved neither, that they are not very strong in themselves. So the Buddha says, she should put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness for gaining those very same skillful qualities. Extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness. Just as when a person whose turban or head was on fire, would put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness to put out the fire on his turban or head. In the same way, the practitioner should yada yada yada. And he promises, at a later time, she will then become one who achieves both insight into phenomena through heightened discernment and internal tranquility of awareness. Tämä on sellainen niin kuin erottelukyky, ehkä. Tai jonkin sortin ymmärrys, näkeminen. So if we would imagine ourselves practicing in a way where we let go of everything, it would actually be very hard. As we've noticed, the force of habit is quite a strong force in human beings, and probably in other beings as well. But I don't, well, let's speak from our experience. So probably if we let go of this extra effort, diligence, relentlessness, many beautiful qualities, we'd probably stay where we are on the path. We actually need a lot of passion, a lot of desire. And it sounds sometimes strange when one reads the suttas, for example. If a practitioner attains concentration, attains singleness of mind founded on desire, that is called concentration founded on desire. She generates desire, endeavors, arouses persistence, upholds and exerts her intent for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities, for the sake of abandoning unskillful qualities, for the sake of arising of skillful qualities, and for the maintenance, non-confusion increase, plenitude development, and a culmination of skillful qualities. These are called the fabrications of exertion. This is desire. This is concentration founded on desire. These are the fabrications of exertion. Concentration founded on desire and the fabrications of exertion. Lovely words. It's like, like a sweet thing to chew on. But like Catherine was yesterday mentioning, to the different contexts in which ideas and teachings are offered, we would do well to remember that the Buddha was actually, like, his way of talking of the practice is sometimes even violent, we could say, or quite militaristic, or kind of playing along an archetype that's the hero archetype or the warrior. So it's a certain type of language he uses. It's not, and how it lands with any of us is something to actually look into, not just take along, just like that. Okay, I'm going to exert myself relentlessly. While sometimes it's a good idea to try it out as well. To see, okay, what's this pointing to? How does it resonate with me? How does it speak to me? What could it mean to me in 2019? And actually, the very, very next sutta from the one I just quoted speaks of a monk called Moggallana. The monk Moggallana develops the base of power endowed with concentration, founded on desire and fabrications of exertion. Sounds familiar? Thinking, this desire of mine will be neither overly sluggish nor overly active, neither inwardly constricted nor outwardly scattered. There's some sense in that. Neither overly sluggish nor overly active, neither inwardly constricted nor outwardly scattered. So there's a lovely sense of a conflict or a kind of a interplay here of, yes, we want something, and we want, well, we might want, I'm speaking for myself, and we want to let go of wanting. So it's something to kind of sense into what's actually going on here. Catherine was maybe referring to this and other things when she spoke of sifting through our passions. What's left in the sieve when we sift through? What do we want to keep? What do we want to follow? And what shall we drop away? My notes remind me of my daughter's kind of these notebooks where there are all sorts of tehtäviä, exercises. It's like the arrows lead from one point to the other. I'm trying to find out where I'm supposed to start. So the name of the retreat is Passion and Dispassion. And so what I'm speaking now of, we could say, is a passion for dispassion, a passion for dispassion. And what it might mean is that we notice that, okay, in my being, in my life, there's all this activity, all this holding on to senses of self, all these ideas of what I need, what I want, what I don't want. And finding the path, we realize, oh, I can actually do something about this. It's possible to learn the skill of letting go. It's possible to learn to develop different qualities in oneself. And maybe for some of you it might be still a new thing. For some of you, you might be on your 30-something youth retreat. But maybe we can remember what it was like to begin. What it was like to begin. What was the kind of, whoa, there's a whole world of a spiritual realm, we could say. There's a path, there's a practice, and there's so much to it. So developing a passion for dispassion, we could say, is one part of this development, this unfolding of the path. And something that triggered a question today in one of the small groups was about what Catherine said yesterday about passion held in dispassion. So as we develop our skill, our kind of a container, as we work with this, whatever we call it, this being, we become more skilled. We can notice this. I can notice in each one of you who I've met on this retreat that you're certainly in a different place than where you were when you started practicing meditation, even if we didn't know back then. It's clear. It's evident. So as this skill of dispassion, as this movement deepens and kind of gets more room in us, we can find, so there's the passion can be held by the dispassion. There's something that's possible here. And expanding a bit on what I said today in the small group, that these skills, we could say that they are, they're kind of a container or a safeguard in a way. That the ability to not identify, the ability to not create a self around a thing, not be able to create an identity around something, the ability to just drop something we know is not skillful, is huge in holding our passion. Also also elemental in understanding that passion is hot. Passion is a fire. And that needs some safeguarding. Also to lead, to look after our action in the world with other people, with ethics. So the skills and the ethics, creating a container for our passion. And at this point it might sound like, well, now the passion has become this secondary thing. It's kind of inside this, this container he's making with his hands right now. And I'm just wondering if it sounds right to you. Because for some reason for me it sounds like, no, the passion is more important. The passion should be primary. And it's not to be kind of a lapdog of dispassion, of wisdom. So that's a reaction in me that comes up as I say those things. But also if we look how the... Well, okay, I was speaking of skills of dispassion. But skills of dispassion is not just some juggling act of, okay, I can do this and I can calm down like this. And but rather it's... The practice transforms us, transforms our understanding of self and of other, of things and of time, of space, of what's real, what's not real, and what passion is as well. So passion is not spared from the transformation of understanding, like the things you have spoke of and Katharina, we've been offering, pointing to the dependent nature of things, dependent nature of experience, that this thing I'm passionate for depends on my way of seeing it, depends on my passion, depends on my conceiving of it, depends on a variety of conceptions I have about the situation. And in a way, this understanding and this skill means that at any point, almost at any point, we know that we could let go, that we could make it dissolve, that we could make it lose its redness. Because the redness was there dependent on ourselves. So not only is it kind of safeguarded by the understanding, by the practice, but it's also what passion is in the first place is changed, and that kind of changes the dynamic I'm making with my hands. It's not just the passion would stay there as it was. Okay. Passion. Maybe some of us might wonder, am I a passionate person? Does this have anything to do with me, or am I a depressed person who doesn't have this kind of any burn, or a very steady person who's not passionate as such? Like, I'm interested in things, am I going for some things, but passion sounds a bit big. And I just wanted to kind of, as I was preparing the talk, also wondering, like, what all does it mean? Like, it's a sexy word, passion. It sounds like, yeah, this is something. And just opening up, like, what does it actually look like? The things we've been passionate about, like, actually, if we consider something we've been passionate about, and what has the relationship been like? What's actually happening when we're passionate about something? Like, sometimes we might be in the throes of passion, and that's one kind of passion for sure. Oftentimes, passions are actually, what's sitka in English?
Resilient?
Resilient, yeah, that's it. Tenacious, yeah. People have better English than mine. So, tenacious, resilient desires or callings. I was just writing up And you can see how these words land in you as I say them. So what does passion look like? What does it feel like? So in passion there's always an intent. There's an intent. An intending. There's a desire. A desire. There might be a resolution, a resoluteness, or a persistence, or an aspiration, an aspiring to. Maybe a longing to, a longing for, or a yearning, or a being called to, a being called to. And these things, and whether one is, finds oneself a passionate person or not, is, well, if we look at the teachings, it's, they would say, well, to consider oneself a passionate person would be avidya. That passion, just like all other things, are conditioned. So we can ask, okay, what enables passion? What opens passion? What brings up passion? What alights us? And likewise, what closes it down? What disables passion? What flattens it? And especially here in the context of passion for the path, passion for practice, passion for liberation, passion for all of the things that are on offer. I thought of a couple of things at least that play into this quite a lot. The sense of self and the sense of possibility for said self. Sense of self is quite a wide, or a conceiving of oneself is quite a wide thing, actually a large thing. But for example, what's the emotional range that's available for me, for this person, for whatever reasons, historical, psychological, or my bringing up, the way of life I'm living. What's the emotional range? Is the range open for passion? And many of the practices here are kind of gently opening that up, hopefully for you. All of these, that the whole of the emotional range is welcome to be felt, to be experienced, to be held in this meditative container. And hopefully as it needs be to be expressed appropriately and skillfully in the meetings with the teachers. But even bigger than that, I feel like, is the sense of possibility or the lack of possibility. So what's possible in this practice? What's possible for me on this path? Very, very much tied to the, we could say, fantasy of the path, so-called practice fantasy. And if you haven't heard of the concept before, it might sound a bit dubious, like fantasies are something to get rid of rather than to make up. But we always have a fantasy of the path. We always have an image of what this practice is about. What's supposed to happen as I sit here? What's it supposed to do to this person? What I would want it to do for me? What I might fear it's not going to do for me? How I project this thing progressing? How I look at my past practice and imagine that, oh, that's how it's going to continue, perhaps. So the fantasy of the path, or the whole path in itself, is like a retreat. It's a made-up thing. It's a skillful fabrication. Of course there is no path. Of course there's no goal of the path. But we can practice without one. And even now, if you ended practicing completely, you'd still have it. So you're kind of trapped in a fantasy of the path. I'm sorry about that. So can the fantasy of the path, can we be kind of conscious of what we have, what we carry with ourselves? Because it's going to massively influence what we feel is possible. Not only like, as I practice, what's possible right now for myself to experience emotionally, conceptually, bodily. But especially in the context of this talk, how it might light my passion for the practice and how it might dampen it. And I can remember for myself that when I started practicing, I don't even understand why I was so enthusiastic about it. It was quite a limited idea, but I guess it was so new and so kind of fantastic sounding that I really went for it. And the first years were very hard for me, very painful, very full of disappointment, we could say. And I had the image that, at least at some point, I remember having this image that, okay, well, if I get some mindfulness together, just some presence, some kindness towards my fellow humans around me, that would be great. That would be like, I'm no longer asking for more than that. That's like a massive thing. And I've been lucky to be blessed with the finest teachers I could ask for. Finer than I could ever imagine I would meet. And luckily, I guess largely, thanks to them, my idea of the path, my idea of its trajectory has evolved from that point. Not only based on what they've said, but through the practice. It turned out that actually these fruits of the practice I was imagining were just the first small bite. And that the further you eat, the further you progress, the larger it seems to be. The horizon just keeps on opening. The buffet is just wider and wider. It's like when you go to a fancy restaurant and you get the kind of welcome here from the chef after you've ordered. It's like this tiny cracker with a pinch of something on it. I'm like, well, that's nice. But then after you had it, first course comes and that's a bit larger, nicer, and then the next. So just for any of you, what might be your idea of where the path is going? What would be possible? Is it being more present in life? More mindful, more with the experience as it's unfolding? Is it a peace that we might arrive at or might discover? A deep peace of some kind, perhaps? In the midst of all we encounter in the world in this day and age. Maybe it's a responsiveness instead of a reactivity. Instead of just reacting to this and that, we could take a breath and respond instead. And why stop there? Why stop there? There's a lovely quote from the Dzogchen tradition, which goes, "Trust your experience, but keep refining your view." Trust your experience, but keep refining your view. And that's a golden line for me. that's truly a golden teaching. To actually go see one's experience and to trust that. And it's funny because we don't that much, oftentimes. Like how many times I've read or heard or been told to look at how you're attending to affects what is attended to. Look at how my way of relating is in interplay with experience. And we know, we can notice this at any moment, at this moment as well. It's never not happening. It's never not happening that our relating to is creating what we relate to, what we experience, or participating in its creation. And the deeper we take that teaching, the deeper we understand it, when it seeps into the bones, I wish it did for me. What kind of a transformation in understanding, in experiencing anything could that make? That understanding of emptiness, that understanding of dependentness. So I'm laying out one kind of a practice fantasy here. I hope you're conscious of that. That's a practice fantasy. That's not real. Doesn't need to be. None of it is, anyway, in that sense. And if we actually know that this is my practice fantasy, this is a fantasy I have of practice, doesn't mean it wouldn't light our passion. Actually, it can go the other way, because then we're no longer in the avidya, in the ignorance, in the deludedness of something being real that is not real in that way. When we willingly say, "Ah, this is a practice fantasy, and it speaks to me, it calls me, it rouses intent, relentless exertion, and all of that." That's a huge driving force on this path. That's not a real path. Trying to solve the puzzle again. Well, maybe just to add to that, that our practice fantasy can be an ever evolving thing. Trusting our experience, but refining our view. What could it be? Where could this be headed to? And that's a natural, it's more than a natural, it's one of the most skillful things in this regard. To not get stuck with our fantasy and the passion dwindling and our desire for practice kind of flattening through time. And part of practice is also self-reflectiveness in this regard, that we can be conscious of this without fear of it losing its power, without fear of it losing its allure, its magic. In the so-called blurb, do you know what a blurb is? It's a funny special word we use in Dharma circles. It's not Pali, though, but still. What we call a retreat blurb is the retreat description. So, Catherine read to us yesterday as well, at least.
First night.
And part of the blurb says, we need the wisdom born of dispassion to discern wisely the multitudes of pathways that well up inside us and around us. We need the wisdom born of dispassion to discern wisely the multitudes of pathways that well up inside us and around us. And it reminded me of a poem by Rumi, the Sufi mystic. A poem called The Many Wines. And this is a part of the poem. There are thousands of wines that can take over our minds. Don't think all ecstasies are the same. Jesus was lost in his love for God. His donkey was drunk with barley. Drink from the presence of saints, not from those other jars. Every object, every being is a jar full of delight. Be a connoisseur and taste with caution. Any wine will get you high. Judge like a king and choose the purest. The ones unadulterated with fear or some urgency about what's needed. The poem actually ends. Drink the wine that moves you as a camel moves when it's being untied and is just ambling about. So, I don't know what he means with that. But what I feel as if I know from the previous parts of the poem is that there are so many things to be passionate about. So many things that could pull us when we start opening to the world, or when we come to the world already. So many things, so many things. How to choose the purest. And when he writes, drink from the presence of saints, not from those other jars, it really calls to me. Who are those saints? When am I in their presence? I'm in the presence of many saints right now, it feels to me. I'm very lucky to drink from their jars. We need the wisdom born of dispassion to discern wisely the multitudes of pathways that well up inside us and around us. So here we start maybe to hear that passion is not just a servant to a path of dispassion, but there, in interplay, one informing the other, one feeding the other. I actually looked at Khalil Gibran's The Prophet while preparing the talk, because there's a chapter on reason and passion. It wasn't any good. I had to put it down. It was too black and white with the reason and passion. Because passion is not an unreasonable thing. It's not, actually. Passion is always connected with a conceiving of. It's not without reason. It's not just some crazy elephant. It's rather... There's a sense of a possibility, a sense of calling. It's richer than that. It's more complicated than that. Let's not put them like against each other, reason and passion. Always intermingled. Like I've had many passions of reason, we could say. Like things in the realm of reason, of thought and analysis, I'd be very passionate about. That shouldn't be possible if passion was just a kind of passion of the flesh or passion of unreason. So passion and dispassion together, informing each other, fueling each other. I'd like to end with another Rumi poem, a favorite of mine. which some of you will have heard. About the sense of possibility, very applicable to times on retreat. And I'll read it twice, just in case. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep.